Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Popular media often depicts some college degrees as less valuable than others, particularly those in the arts and the humanities. One such degree that often gets scorned and derided in the media is art history. But I can say from personal experience as a political and military historian and an Army intelligence officer that I have found my art history experience to be invaluable. Here with me today to discuss the importance and value of art history is my guest, Dr. James Hudson, professor of art and design at Lindenwood University. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Let's start at the very beginning. Why art history?
Glad you asked. Now more than ever, art history is important and crucial because more and more information is communicated visually in our culture. Everything from material culture to politics to ways in which to engage with social media and now the metaverse as well. And so understanding and being able to interpret different visual cues, symbols, and other semiotic associations when it comes to meaning and how we confer meaning by way of either spoken or visual means is central now to being able to navigate the complex sociopolitical interactions we have with people on a daily basis. So really being able to be visually literate or visual literacy is what we often call it. What we often also do is provide the ability to verbalize the visual so that you're able to actually say why you like or don't like something or why something might be considered abrasive or offensive or attractive. So all of these things have very practical skills. And what is very interesting about art history when it comes to a discipline, and especially thinking of previous politicians who talked about useless degrees and actually named art history as one of them, and then wound up apologizing because a prominent art historian actually wrote to him and gave this long series of studies about how the success rate of graduates and the types of careers they wound up getting later on were actually much more successful than other areas. But here, what's interesting as far as art history is I find many of my students, as far as the undergraduates, they go on into fields such as marketing, such as healthcare, insurance, et cetera, but especially advertising and marketing I keep seeing. And so they're given an edge because they understand this language and the ability to interpret and speak about things in a visual way that others just aren't able to do. And that sets them apart from their more traditionally trained contemporaries.
What are the basic subfields that you have in art history?
Subfields. There are a lot of subfields in art history. Traditionally, people probably think about, if they took an art history class, probably a survey. They might have covered ancient Egypt and Rome and Greece, and maybe they covered the Ninja Turtles and the Renaissance, and then maybe they got the Jackson Pollock if they were lucky. But the fields of study actually are more diverse now, and the biggest shift and the biggest movement, as well as most other disciplines, is to decenter the West, to look at the effects of colonization, and to be more inclusive of a broader community. So the subsets of art history, you have your basic specializations. You'll have those that are Romanists, that are Sinologists, that are early modern Italianists like myself, or they might be 19th century French specialists like Dr. Olson we have here on staff as well. So we have those that are in different areas. You generally have to get your PhD in one of those areas of specialization. But then in practice, you go out and do many different things, such as history of architecture or of art history and semiotics, the study of signs and symbols. Or they might, I know a lot of them actually, since I went to school out in the DC area, that went on and were recruited by the CIA and other agencies because we have to learn foreign languages as well. And that was kind of ideal because they were, you have to travel a lot, you have to go and be familiar with other cultures and other countries, be able to talk across difference. And so it's one of those fields that moves in many different directions because art history as a discipline itself evolved out of sociology and history in the 19th century in Germany. And so as a social science discipline is how it originally was understood, was a way in which to remove art as the rhapsodizing of connoisseurs and making it something concrete and scientific that you can classify and talk about and show as reflecting the values of a particular culture. And so with that, you have automatically different disciplines overlaid and intertwined with it. So you can go into specific areas such as particular fields, geographically, chronologically. You can focus on certain topics, which are the most popular now, such as gender, equality, equity, sexuality studies, anything relating to race and ethnicity. So all of these are subsets that you'll often find.
So art history can tell us a great deal about a culture, mm-hmm. but can it tell us a great deal about time? Can it tell us about
a
circumstance.
Sure, there's a great book I'd recommend there, actually written by an anthropologist called The Shape of Time. And so time itself, if you look at it, art history shows us cultural time instead of, say, a biological or geographical, meteorological time in this way. So if you look at where we are now, we consider ourselves a developed nation, and then you have those that are developing. So this is not a chronological difference, it is a cultural difference. And so what art history is able to do is show us not only the shape of time as we have built it in the Western civilization, are now rewriting it to include the rest of the world that we cut out, because the narrative that we have, interestingly enough, is intimately intertwined with art as representing nations that come to fruition and develop and become the penultimate example of civilization at the end. So what art history does is encodes, and by the way, there's no such thing as art historically. Art is a myth is actually a good way to describe it, because every civilization prior to the 19th century was not making art for aesthetic purposes. And before we get to the Enlightenment, there is no idea of separating out, appreciating something purely for the fact that it's beautiful or it impacts you in a particular way. It always served a religious or political function, and usually the same time. So it shows you both the religion of a civilization and how the politics and the hegemonic structure are going to support that in a type of superstructure. So everything from the Parthenon in Greece, where you're going to have the idea of a god that's going to be a patron deity and protecting the city and thus named after the city, the Athenians, but also showing you their relationship to those gods, or the pyramids, in which you have these type of god kings that are living among us, and so you have to have a way in which for them to live on in the afterlife. Or you move all the way up to the cathedrals of Europe and the Renaissance and moving forward. What is most interesting and the point of art now, and I guess I should mention very importantly that the shape of time and what art tells us about it is really wrapped up in the institution of the museum. And there's a big movement right now if you look at the hashtag museums are not unbiased. And so the idea is everything is biased in the selections that we made. And go to any museum, just like the St. Louis Art Museum we have here, and it's a good representation of what developed out of the nation-state museum. So there were no museums prior to the late 18th centuries when you start seeing them proliferating, especially in the 19th century. But that's when you have the rise of the nation-state. That's when you have, you know, Italy coming together, you have France once again, you have England, and then bits and pieces of the old Holy Roman Empire trying to differentiate themselves and show that each one was culturally superior to the other. And so what develops out of that, we can thank Napoleon for kind of solidifying this with the Napoleon Museum as he's looting all of Europe, is when they set up a museum, it is the story of why you're the best country ever. And we have that here in the U.S. as well. So every museum in the 19th century, and they're still set up this way if you go to any major museum in Europe or the National Gallery of Art or any major museum in the U.S., you always begin with ancient Egypt. You move on to the classical period with the Greeks and the Romans. You then move on to the Renaissance. And then finally, you might have some 19th century works, but you end up with the work of your own country that is contemporary. So if you're in Germany, if you go to the Altes Museum or others in Museum Island, it's going to end up with contemporary German painters or modern German art. If you go to the St. Louis Art Museum, it ends up, if you follow it from even non-Western through antiquity, it ends up with American art, so as being the penultimate. In France, you go to the Louvre and the others, it's going to be the modern French artists. So all of that is to say art is an argument for a civilization's cultural superiority. And so now the job is to decenter that, so we're giving all those back. I mean, most museums exist because of ill-gotten gains from the past. So colonization, bringing back things from Africa and Asia. So we're just now seeing the National Gallery in London giving the Benin bronzes back to Africa and repatriating all these things that we had. So then we have to rethink, what is a museum if we can't have a microcosm of the entire world in one space to go through all of history and all of time to give us this grand narrative that we constructed?
That leads me to another question.
Do individual types of art tell us different things, such as the sculpture, painting, architecture? Do they tell us different things about these societies?
Yes. So if you look at all of time, the vast majority of works that have survived, and when people generally think of art, they think of the Mona Lisa, which is, by the way, only famous because it was stolen in the early 20th century. It's not really even Leonardo's best work, so you shouldn't think that's the best work ever. But when you think of art, right, you think of generally an oil painting, a panel painting on canvas that's flat, that's on a wall, and it's framed. But that represents, throughout all of history, a vast minority. That came out of the altarpiece tradition in the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, and then developed propped into these freestanding works that we appreciate originally were propped up on altars. So before that, majority of what we have are actually what we consider material culture and architecture. So the buildings are what's left over from antiquity, what people use on a daily basis for religious ceremonies, ceramics, pots, etc. They all, in art historical terms, each object encodes meaning, and some are better at encoding meaning than others, is the idea, which is a highly controversial idea. But so the notion is, if you go into a museum, you'll notice you generally separate things that we believe are really great at communicating what a civilization is all about, like Washington crossing the Delaware is like our national painting, or if we're talking about Holland, the representative, the patriotic painting is going to be the Night Watch by Rembrandt. It represents the country. So those are good examples of those that have high encoding power. We think that they represent a multi-layered interpretation of what a civilization is, their cultural values, what their struggles were, what, once again, they strive to be, how they want to be represented. But then you have a different class of objects, which we're just now starting to pay attention to, which is previously called either decorative art or material culture. So at the St. Louis Art Museum, that would be, for instance, the furniture that you have downstairs, the history of modern furniture. Or if you go upstairs, you look at remnants of Native American culture, everything from moccasins to baby bassinets to everything else. So people would generally, in art historical terms, say those have less power to encode meaning about a culture because they were practical and weren't instead something that was designed to be intellectual or theoretical. The issue with that, of course, is that in those instances, we are assuming people used art in ways that they didn't. Native Americans specifically, and I grew up on a Cherokee reservation actually in Oklahoma, they famously have a statement is, we have no word for art. There is no differentiation between what they make that ties into their tradition, their religion, their connection to their ancestors and understanding of their connection to nature and aesthetic appreciation. They're one and the same.
We can see that in other things also around the world. My wife would point out that many of the Pils glasses I brought back from Europe are very aesthetically beautiful, but they were practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so they added the aesthetics to it, but that wasn't, the aesthetics were not the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that you and I had talked about earlier is that, you said, particularly in the 20th century, all art is political.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Sure. So if you pick up any art journal, the St. Louis Art Museum, if you're a member of any museum, and you look at what exhibitions are coming up, or if you look at any survey text on art, you'll notice that up until the 19th century, you can always see images of rulers, dynastic portraits, etc. So all of it is there to communicate and reinforce who's in charge, who has the power, and why. Moving past that, as we went through the period of modernism in the 20th century, art's purpose changed into, we can actually have a painting of a blue dot, or we can have mirror cubes, and they don't reflect or necessarily speak to a particular ruler. But all of that art, once we run the course of modernism and it dies a horrible death, according to some, after Jackson Pollock, and there's only so far you can go after you go through conceptual art and abstract art and neo-expressionism. But what happens after that with postmodernism especially is art was inward-looking, a way to think about it, for most of the 20th century. The belief was that art itself is the point, that we don't need to look for meaning outside of it. The meaning is the spiritual journey that a completely abstract work of art can provide us. So things like Rothko's wonderful paintings where you are supposed to meditate on these broad swaths of color until you're able to get in touch with the divine and or focus your mind on things that are otherworldly. So it's always internally focused. So once we have that run its course and then we start bringing things back in like pop art and Lichtenstein and Warhol, everything becomes intensely political and must comment on or move us in a particular direction. And generally that is in such a way to challenge the status quo, and that's where you get the culture war. Especially coming out, peaking in the 80s and 90s, when you have the AIDS crisis and others. So anything that you think of, whether it be Damien Hirst's Mother and Child Divided, where he's cutting apart giant cows and putting them in vitrines, or giant great white sharks, or if we're talking about, even now we have The Comedian, which is a great example of contemporary art, which is literally a banana that an artist duct taped to a wall and then sold it for 20 grand. So any number of things, because art is about the idea, but it's not significant unless it leads us to question whether or not we are being inclusive, pluralistic, respectful of different perspectives, and challenging this notion of there being one correct answer and one correct expert and voice in the room, when in fact you have different perspectives perspectives and they all have different experiences that are equally viable. So then how do we then navigate that? So everything from the piss Christ, crucifying yourself in a Volkswagen, in performance art, where you're going to, in Meat Joy, be rubbing yourself with raw poultry to talk about the objectification of women. All of it is leading towards this understanding of holding a mirror up to society. So that's really what art is supposed to do now if it's good.
That's kind of interesting. When we're looking at art from other cultures, how much can that tell us about that particular culture? What are the things we can draw out of the art we might be able to say, oh, okay, when I go visit this culture that I now, I can use this information for interacting with the population?
That's a great question and a major misconception that previous generations had before new art history came about. A great example of that is Abbie Vorberg. So he is going to be working in London, but he did a lot of anthropological and art historical studies of the Pueblo people of the Southwest. And the idea was, in all of his interpretation, he thought he was interpreting what they were thinking and what they believed appropriately, but he was doing it through a lens of Western mythology and Western gods and Western understanding of the world. So yes, the art of other cultures tells us sometimes that's all we have, right? If you look at a lot of Mesoamerican cultures, we don't have the same type of writing systems or even South American cultures, right? You have a series of knots that were actually used by the Incans instead of pictographs or something. So that might be all that we have. But today, if you were to look at, say, a mosque or a vase from China, or if you're looking at a contemporary Buddhist temple. So you would be taking your own perception if you don't take the time to also learn about that culture first. So famously, art history uses iconography, which is an approach to analyze works developed by Erwin Panofsky. And it works best for Western art and art that's based on books and based on the written word. So we can use this method of analyzing why the Last Supper holds meaning for Leonardo da Vinci and the monks he painted it for in a particular monastery by using this technique of going through a formal analysis, going through to understand that, just like to understand a Shinto shrine, you need to understand and be familiar with the culture, with the religious beliefs, with a basic understanding of, okay, the culture looking at this would have been Catholic. They would have understood the guy with the halo to be Christ. They would have understood these to be his disciples. So we know that given their table and they're all together, it's the Last Supper. So all of this we could assume the viewer would know. But in order to do that, we need to know basic things about the culture first, because otherwise we misinterpret things. This has happened many times in the 20th century, and also why we outlawed, say, tattooing when the Christian missionaries came to the Polynesian islands. So they considered it to be demonic, etc., or outlawing certain types of language, or outlawing certain types of sand painting or productions or Navajo sand painting, because they misunderstood what it was, and they thought it was pagan, anti-Christian, that it went against our cultural values in the West, because they didn't understand the context in which it was made. So yes, it can, but you can never undervalue other disciplines like history, anthropology, sociology, and these other areas, because you need a basic understanding of the religion, the politics, the gender expectations, the social contract, and the understanding that they would have for kinship systems. So that being, are you expected to marry at a particular age? Do you have to have so many kids? Are you expected to get a profession at a particular time? Do you need to do X? So all of this, you need some basic understanding of for a work of art to be effectively interpreted.
My next question is going to require just a bit of setup.
Many years ago, when I was a master's candidate at the University of Arizona, I get called into a meeting with a bunch of the faculty, which I didn't necessarily know why I'm being called in, but I'm sitting there and I watch a presentation by these two individuals who were art historians, and they were talking about hidden meanings in a particular set of paintings and talking about this being code and encoded information. And what was bizarre from my perspective is I'm the only graduate student in this room. I've got 17 historians, these two gentlemen, nice gentlemen, by the way, and myself. And they do this whole story about codes. And my advisor looks over at me and goes, "So, Don, you're our specialist on codes. What do you think?" And so that has always led to the question, are there places in art, I don't even want to ask if it's common, but are there times that art is used to send hidden messages?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it's kind of funny that you mentioned that. So one way in which you could bring your experience together with the type of iconographical and iconological interpretations would be through the triadic system of semiotics. So that would be the closest we could do it, like using the indexical and the icon and these different elements to break down what the meaning is. That's as close as we can get it. Art historians don't use semiotics as much anymore. But yeah, so for instance, in order to communicate messages? Absolutely. So we have, for instance, Jackson Pollock, and his drip painting was seen as the quintessential free American expression that was anti-communist. And so the CIA actually spent a lot of time teaching those in Central America and the Southwest to paint in this way, especially Native Americans, to ensure that they weren't moving to the side of social realism that communism was using at the time. And so that was inadvertently, which they didn't know at the time, making them patriotic because they were learning to paint in this free Western cowboy masculine way. That's the way Pollock was seen, since he claimed to come from Wyoming, but he was only there for a few years, but kind of Western cowboy. Others throughout history, as far as code, if you think of like the Da Vinci Code, which is entirely not based in reality, there are encoded messages, but not the way most people think that Dan Brown would write. As far as conspiracy theories, the Illuminati, the Freemasons, etc., that you see in like National Treasure and these other movies, most are relatively straightforward and are meant to communicate things to particular subsets of groups. So for instance, it may be intended for a Catholic audience, but you'll have a particular saint, so you know that you're actually arguing for the superiority of the Oratorian order versus the Jesuit order. So these subtle little things, like you might place a figure in an image, and I'm trained in the Western tradition, so I apologize, but you might place a particular saint higher above another one, thus showing the superiority of your particular organization over another. So there are, as far as symbolism, symbolism comes from cultural context, and meaning changes over time. So you find that you may mean to encode a particular message, but if you think of through reception theory that I can say one word, but depending upon the experiences of the listener, it might be interpreted a myriad different ways. And so it's the context in which something is being viewed and or talked about. So look at a great example we use is watch movies with the Twin Towers in them from the 80s. You watch that, it meant something entirely different, representing the power and economic might and globalization at the time that meant, but you cannot help but think about 9/11 now. And so it's impossible, that type of, you can't divorce it from historical context. And things change meaning over time. Words change meaning and images change their meaning as to what's appropriate. So for instance, the American flag is a great example of things that change meaning and are encoded. There are any number, if you just drive down the highway, any number of different representations of the flag with different colorations, which have entirely different political and or organizational or sexual implications. So you might have something that would be showing your support of law enforcement or showing your support of Black Lives Matter or showing your support for equal rights and gender equality. So all of that is within the context and shifts all the time. We see that constantly now with meme culture, with internet culture, and you can take something that would be either considered incredibly liberal or conservative, and that same image can flip its interpretation and its symbolic meaning to the viewer based upon the time you're looking at it, the audience, and the context. So yes, there's symbolism everywhere, but it's all contextual. There is no meaning in a book. There is no meaning on the piece of paper we have in front of us, or there is no meaning in the Mona Lisa. The meaning comes from you reading that piece of paper, that you understand English, you know what the words are supposed to say, the words we're saying right now resonating through the air. We agree that these nonsensical sounds have meaning and are tied to a system of communication and language. And the same way with art. Art is just a bunch of colors, lines, and shapes on a surface, or it's going to be a building, or it's a sculpture. It has no meaning whatsoever unless the culture or the person looking at it says, ah, that's supposed to be a dog. That dog is going to be associated with this particular deity. That dog is supposed to be here because it shows the deity is responsible for this particular aspect of life. So, but that's all within the context of me understanding that and looking at it and engaging with it.
Art history has always struck me as fun because there are also so many colorful characters.
Michelangelo. And I'm afraid I can't remember the cardinal that he had a particular problem with.
Yeah, yeah. Aldobrandini, yep.
Would you mind telling the story of how Michelangelo got
back at him?
Oh, sure. Fun fact, though, the most recent research that we have coming out in Michelangelo is they found one of his shoes, and we can now estimate his height at 5'1". So he was a very small guy by the standards of today, but even by the standards of the Renaissance, if you're talking about average height being 5'3 to 5'4". So imagine him painting the Sistine Chapel, and this leads to the answer to your question. He didn't lay on his back, he sent off these complaining letters with little cartoons and caricatures of him reaching up and looking up. So he complained of neck pain for the rest of his life. But after he finished the Sistine Chapel, he was called back by Pope Pius later in his life in the 1530s, to then paint the Last Judgment above the main altar. So as he's painting it, remember, this is a time in which you have the Protestant Reformation running rampant through areas of Italy. And they obviously, if you're Catholic, they see it as a very bad thing, and they think the end of the world is coming. Half of the population of Europe has defected to this heretical religion as they see it. So there's a lot of Catholic anxiety. So that's represented in Michelangelo's Last Judgment by the distortions in space, by compressing things. Everyone is nervous and contorted. Christ is focusing his attention on the damned instead of the saved. And then one cardinal walked in one day and complained to him and the Pope as well. Why do we have all these nude figures here in the Sistine Chapel? This is a place of God, etc. And so Michelangelo, then very upset and hurt by, he was a very prideful man and very sensitive as well. So he always got his feelings hurt. And according to psychoanalytic studies, had what we would know as daddy issues, because he was left by his father with a nursemaid. And so there's the whole backstory there. But he has issues with criticism, and especially criticism from older male figures. But he also craves their praise and their approval. And so he was very upset. So in hell, he winds up painting Cardinal Aldobrandini nude with Midas ears, so as a fool who doesn't understand it, so donkey ears, in other words. And then based on the Laocoon, which is a sculpture in the Vatican collection of a nude man with his sons being eaten alive by snakes. So he had a snake also eating his genitals at the same time. So this rather unfortunate representation wasn't really approved by the cardinal, because he didn't want to be shown with his genitals being eaten by a snake with donkey ears and naked in hell. So he complains to the Pope and says, why would you let him do this? This is awful. I can't believe this is something that you will allow in the house of God. And of course, the Pope, knowing how irascible Michelangelo is and thinking it's also funny, according to most of the letters that we have, said that he's the Pope. So he holds sway over heaven and earth, but has no control over hell. So that you're going to have to let that ride with Michelangelo. Yeah, so there's lots of stories like that to where people will. Another great one actually like that was famously Luca Signorelli painted a similar chapel, San Brizio Chapel in Orvieto, which is what Michelangelo based the Last Judgment on, by the way. It's in the same province, ruled by the Pope as well. Beautiful, beautiful church. But in it, he began painting demons pulling people into hell. And while painting it, he had learned that very publicly his wife had cheated on him and made it well known that she was stepping out on him. So he painted her in hell being tormented by a demon just to get back at her. So people do things like this throughout all of art history.
That's one of those things I think makes art history actually very interesting for someone like myself, who I find it valuable in general, but then you find these fun little stories that go
about these people, and they may be geniuses and amazing artists, but they're also human.
I think sometimes we have a misconception about what making art is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And seeing that these people are, we talked about Michelangelo is this
great
mind.
Michelangelo, yeah.
And going, yeah, he can also be pretty petty. And funnily petty, in the sense that you go, yeah, that's actually pretty humorous.
Oh, yeah. So. Oh, yeah. The things that, oh, goodness. Yeah. And interestingly enough, they were very open about it. So if you read Vasari's Lives of the Artists, which is one of the first examples that led to art history, they're chocked full of those little anecdotes, even about murder, about someone getting upset and running away from monks because he was only fed cheese and he kept farting too much. Like, all kind of random stuff is in there. One guy was scared of, for instance, Piero di Cosimo. He's going to be terrified of lightning storms and fire, so he only eats boiled eggs the rest of his life. I mean, there are some weird, what's the proper term that we would use for that, eccentric individuals. Yeah, so, but not people that you would think would be above reproach, that were incredibly untouchable, and that are these individuals to be revered. So through time and propaganda, they become Michelangelo.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. We'll come back again and have another conversation on this very fascinating topic.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Glad being here.
And we'll be back soon.